audiences around the nation booed as RuPaul sent Ben de la Creme home after failing to lip sync for his life on RuPaul's Drag Race. Even though Ben de la won the show's opening challenge, the judges said his looks on the runway were off the mark. This made no sense, since Ben looked flawless.
Ben ended up in the bottom two with Darian Lake, who, like a pit bull, latched onto the ankle of Ben's ego early in the season and wouldn't let go. Many expected to see Darian get her comeuppance for being an unreasonable bitch, but in the end, Ben sashayed away, leaving everyone to wonder what happened.
Today, we put a little Ben de la Creme into our coffee as he joins us to talk about his burlesque roots in Chicago, being gal pals with season 5 winner Jinx Monsoon, and how he used drag to overcome shyness.
Join us for this on all the hot news. Dolly Parton clarifies the decades-long lesbian rumors.
A new study says up talking like a valley girl like this is really annoying and will cost you a job promotion.
Prince Harry says he'll go gay if he breaks up with his current girlfriend.
And all your questions. You don't want to miss the show. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Hey, Hunty. We have a fierce, fabulous Hunty t-shirt for sale on our website, feastoffun.com/store. Feast of Fun is made possible because of financial support of listeners like you. Upgrade your account today and access all our shows with the world's top drag queens only at feastoffun.com/plus.
Hello, this is Ben de la Creme.
Hi, Ben de la Creme. It's Fausto Fernos.
And Mark Fillion from Feast of Fun. How are you today?
How are you good. Doing?
Good. How are you guys?
Ben, the two of us need look no more. We both found what we were looking for. A knife to stab Darianne in the back.
Oh,
and
no.
You, my friend, will see you got a fan in me.
Yay.
Thank you. I've been waiting to sing that for years to you.
You've been working on that for a long time, have you?
We just came up with that the last minute.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. But you know what? I really, there's so much, I'm hearing so much kind of, I mean, I know a lot of it's in jest, but there's so much really negative stuff about Darian that's not in jest that I am just like, oh, let's all just be nice to her. Because she didn't, you know, like the reality is Darian didn't kick me off. Rue did, you know, so.
Okay, let me rewrite that. A knife to stab Rue in the back.
Well, don't do that because then I'll get sued or something.
Now, I know you well enough because you used to be a Chicago girl dancing here under the name of Tina Angst.
Tina Angst. Two E's. Yeah.
I know the look on your face when you feel like you've been fucked with.
Yeah.
And that look on the runway was like, oh no, she better don't.
Well, you know, I was surprised by it. Like, I wasn't actually expecting that outcome going into that challenge. Like, I, you know, and it's interesting because you see it on TV and you have a really different perspective because you... You know, when you're there, you know, the judges are talking for a long time and they can often be kind of cryptic and they can often contradict themselves. Like one week they'll say one thing. And when I say week, I mean day. And then they'll sort of say the opposite. So, but once I saw,
so you're like, I don't know what the fuck you want. You crazy bitches want.
Well, sometimes it was like, oh my God, we love your silhouette. Yeah. We love like this thing you're doing. And then other time, and then it would be like, well, we've seen this a lot. And, you know, and that's, and so that's, and that's not to say, you know, there, I certainly think the judges are trying to like give the feedback to like guide you in the direction they want. Just sometimes it can be really hard to interpret, but seeing it on TV, it's like all simplified and boiled down. So it's like, oh yeah, I missed the mark on that one. But going into that challenge, I felt really good about all my looks. I was like, oh, they love this silhouette and this burlesque thing. So I'll like keep giving it to them, but I'll like try to bump it up and like make it, you know, like give them a little, you know, like nude illusion, jewel tone. You know, I was, yeah, just
well,
trying to.
I kind of want to talk about your burlesque roots here in Chicago, because I was really surprised that they didn't have like a burlesque challenge for you guys or anything that showcased your sensuality, because you serve blow up doll realness in a lot of your looks.
Ooh, how sensual, a blow up
But you have this like cheesecake Veronica Lake 1950s sensibility, and
sure.
I think like a burlesque challenge where you were forced to disrobe or titillate right. or tease the audience would have really worked in your favor.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's true of so many queens who go on there and like what the nature of the challenges are. You really don't. I mean, anybody who's had the experience of getting to know a queen through Drag Race and then going to see them live knows that Drag Race might give you a sense of some things about a queen or the person behind the queen, but you don't necessarily get a real good feel for what it is they do on stage. And so, that's not like unique to me in that sense. But yeah, I mean, of course, I would have loved that opportunity because that is something that I think is sort of my wheelhouse.
What was the most exciting and satisfying moment of the series for you to actually experience in person?
Well, definitely that Snatch Game win was really amazing. You know, Snatch Game sort of feels like from my perspective, Snatch Game was the thing going in that I was most nervous about and like most wanted to succeed in. And
you did Maggie Smith from, you know, Downton Abbey, but you had another, they make you come up with two choices, right? What was your other choice?
Well, originally I really wanted to do Miss Piggy, but of course she's a trademarked character, so you can't do that.
Oh, really? Can you give us some Miss Piggy on the phone right now?
Oh, RuPaul!
Yay! That's really good. Say, Kermie, I want you to fuck me up the butt. Pork me.
Oh, my goodness. Kermie, pork me. Oh, God. Wait.
Do you know, if you search Piss Miggy on YouTube, a friend of ours here in Chicago has a Miss Piggy doll, mm-hmm. and he does this hysterical thing where he's a foul mouth Miss Piggy and Piss Miggy.
We heard some of the people talking about when they developed Miss Piggy, and they were came up with the concept, and they were like, well, what do we do for her voice? How do we do the voice? And they said, well, what would happen if a male truck driver woke up in the body of a female pig? What would that sound like?
Oh,
and
my
that's
God.
How they, so basically, you know, Miss Piggy is a trucker trans pig.
Well, it's like, I feel like as soon as I like figured out that, you know, because I always was in love with Miss Piggy as a kid, which I think a lot of our people were. But I, you know, as soon as I sort of like put it together that like, oh, Frank Oz voices this, this is like the first drag queen I was ever obsessed with, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Mm. And it kind of like had an influence on everything you did.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, Miss Piggy, Girl Gremlin, Bugs Bunny, whenever he put on a dress. Yeah, like those are my main drag influences.
I wonder if any of the drag queens both came up with the same character and started fighting, be like, I'm doing Anna Nicole Smith. No, I'm doing Anna Nicole. Because Anna Nicole Smith is a really easy character to imitate. All you need to go is say, trim spot, baby.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's definitely, like, Anna Nicole's one of those things where there's so many indicators that it feels, like, broad enough to be super easy, but Adore's Anna Nicole was so specifically dead on that it was pretty impressive. I mean, because I've seen a lot of drag queens do Anna Nicole, and that was by far the most kind of transcendent version of that I've seen.
But Snatch Game is definitely a highlight of this season, and you know, congratulations for winning that particular segment. It was
thank you.
Well done.
I know. I'm glad that a home girl, because I don't know you've been living in Seattle for a while, but we think of you here in Chicago as a Chicago girl.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I still think of myself as being from Chicago, even though I'm actually not from Chicago originally. But you know, I lived there for 8 years or something. And
a long time, yeah. You were like performing in drag clubs here in town and with burlesque shows. And were you involved, or did you go see when Margaret Cho took all her clothes off?
I was in that show.
You were in that show. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
And you were, remember that the audience didn't take too much of a shining to Margaret Cho's act.
You know, the thing is that it wasn't, you know, like when you're doing a show, you're like backstage fussing with things the whole time. So I actually wasn't privy to what happened on stage. So I don't actually.
Yeah, people were throwing starbursts at her.
Well, this is what happened. There was a mob of people that showed up just to see Margaret Cho naked.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, Margaret Cho takes it all off was the you know, in the publicity materials. And she performed twice in the evening. And the first time, it was in the middle of the show. She never took anything off. And people were like, this is bullshit. And like half the crowd left.
Oh, really?
And then everybody started performing, and then she came out, and she did this other crazy burlesque number with stuff that you would find at a gift shop, you know? Like she would have to sashay away in the concert. And so some audience member decided to start fucking with her and started throwing candy at her while she was stripping on stage.
Are you serious?
Really fucked up.
That's really fucked up, yeah.
Yeah, the only performance I've ever seen people throw stuff at is Margaret Cho, and then Fifi O'Hara, people were throwing change at her.
Oh, it's awful.
It is awful.
I'm thinking about this Margaret Cho show, and because again, like I didn't
was
actually.
Was that the Vic?
Yeah, I didn't actually get to watch the acts, but didn't she have a? I remember that there was an act that was a fan dance.
Yes.
Like, and I heard, like, I heard about it, I didn't see it, but then when she did her final reveal, she was wearing like a prosthetic penis.
That's correct. Yes. We were all there. It was like a legendary moment.
But which one is that? Is that the?
That was the second one.
That was the second one. Yes. And people didn't like it.
Well, people were like, huh? They were like, she has a penis? What is that?
Like, huh?
Well, it didn't look like a penis.
The penis was the reveal. That was the end. And so then after that, she was off stage. So it was just kind of like the starburst and stuff like that. That happened beforehand.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. I don't know what to say about that. Like, I think it's a shame because that actual event was Girlesque Burlesque, and it was produced by the Sissy Butch Brothers, and the whole thing was a fundraiser for the
Red Top Surgery is what the rumor is.
No, it was a documentary they were making about Dixie, what's her name? I'm gonna get this wrong and embarrass myself in front of the entire burlesque community, but this burlesque dancer named Dixie, whose last name is escaping me at the moment, was the founder of the Burlesque Hall of Fame in Las Vegas, and she's like, you know, was like the super legendary famous burlesque dancer who then like was plunged into poverty and like lived in like a shack in the middle of the desert, essentially, where she kept all these burlesque memorabilia from sort of the heyday of burlesque, and people started coming to visit her there at this remote location, and it started building and building and building, and now it's turned into this burlesque festival that is started just as people visiting her in her little, you know, shanty where she had all her memorabilia, and now it's the biggest burlesque festival in the nation, if not the world. And so they were making a documentary about this woman's life, and that's what all those shows were fundraisers for.
Oh. Did the documentary ever get made?
You know, I don't know. I know that there was like they ran into a lot of hangups along the way. I don't know that it was ever released.
The rumor was that the money was all taken for somebody's top surgery.
Oh, well, I don't think that's a true rumor, but
it's not the truth.
We've often heard from people from past seasons of RuPaul's Drag Race that they'll wake up in the morning in their hotel room and they'll find like a checkout paper, like, today you're checking out, and they're like, huh, I'm not checking out, and then that's the day that they up for elimination and go home.
Oh, Lord, did
that happen at all this season?
That didn't happen to me. If it happened to anybody else, I don't know about it.
Okay. Yeah, I think after we've revealed it enough times, they stop doing that.
Because it happened
practice.
On Mimi, yeah. I'm first season. And I want to say it happened the next season too, and the season before. Like there was three seasons.
Jiggly confirmed that. Manila Luzon confirmed that, and Mimi, I'm first, and Pandora have all said that.
Yeah.
So if you were lip syncing but you weren't eliminated, you didn't get that slip?
Right.
No, they knew. They knew who was going home before it was even announced.
Yeah. So like Mimi, she like, well, you know, because you know the show's taped in 2 days. The first day you have that challenge. The next day is the runway. Well, the day you do the runway, Mimi wakes up and she finds a paper on the thing. Like, you know, here's your bill. You know, we're checking you out. Even though the bill's is already taken care of.
Right.
And then it was just kind of like, and it happened to like several other people. So they're like, kind of like if you knew you got that bill, you knew you were going home.
Man. Well, yeah, no, nothing like that happened when I was there. That seems like not a great production decision, just because it seems like it would... Well, it would take a fuck up.
I'm sure it was somebody's fuck
up.
Well,
or maybe they're just like trying to fuck with the performers' heads. I mean, do you feel like it was there was some psychological warfare happening behind the scenes? Darianne Lake act like such a bitch? Were you asking yourself, What did I do?
You know, I definitely was. You know, again, it's like Darian had those moments, but like they were really subtle when we were actually there. You know, like they were small things. And like the first thing that sort of happened was I wasn't, you know, she didn't pick me on that team, which in retrospect, I'm like, it's drag, it's not personal. But what you didn't see before that was that I actually felt like Darian and I had sort of like a friendship connection before that. So I was just like on a, and what she said made sense. She was like, why would I pick this like vintage burlesque queen to be on my rap team? You know, but at the time I was just like, oh, my friend didn't pick me. So that kind of started this thing. And then there's like, so why do you and Darian hate each other? And I'm like, we don't hate each other. What are you talking about? You know, and all you need is to get like our tired, cranky drag queen at the end of the day to say like a couple vaguely snarky things. And then you like score it. And then it's TV, you know. So
at what point during the taping and the series did you realize that was the direction they wanted to take you and your and Darian's relationship in?
It was pretty quickly after that. I mean, it was, let's see, I'm trying to think of like what the whole timeline was of this. So, that rap challenge was, that rap challenge was right before they did the thing where they teamed us all, like Rue picked the teams for the commercials. And like, at that point I knew that it was like, oh, we're like, pretendemies. Is that, that's pretend an enemy.
Frenemies.
Yeah,
pretend
no, my
frenemies.
Frenemies
or something like that. I mean, just, did it ever like occur to either of you to say, let's fuck with the producers and be best friends and hold hands and make out?
You know, you don't like, there's like, if only one could like have enough control over the situation to seize it in that way, you know. I mean, like, we're like, none of the queens, we can't interact when the cameras aren't on. Like, they keep us, you know, separated and silent. So so anything that's happening is kind of like driven by the adrenaline levels of what's happening in front of the camera.
So if you're sitting there putting on your makeup and the camera's not on you, you're not supposed to talk to the person next to you,
right? Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Now, one thing that was said during the series, which I also felt very was incongruous, was we know you as a fully fleshed human being, and Ben de la Creme is delightful and doesn't feel artificial or fake in any way. But they kept saying that, like, Ben's a character and Ben's this, like, artifice.
We don't know who you are.
We don't know who you are. And I'm like, well, why don't you ask him who he is? I mean, he'd be happy to tell you.
Well, you know, and that's what kind of like, you know, that episode where I was almost eliminated and then wasn't, you know, you saw me kind of like have that super tearful moment, which was really, I mean, like, of course I was super shaken from thinking I was going home at that moment after I'd sort of felt like I was doing really well. But like, really, that a lot of that emotion was, that was like the first time that Michelle like really was like, I don't see you and I don't know who you are, which felt like, I mean, that was like a really intense thing for me to hear, because I feel like I am really genuine through this character that I've created. You know, the reason this character exists is to like take down the like inhibitions and the distance that I have as like a whole human, you know, like, you know, I think that we as like, you know, we as people, and certainly a lot of us as gay men, have a lot of social kind of walls up in terms of what we think we're supposed to be or supposed to do, and how we want to express ourselves. And when I put on drag, it's like, I'm not afraid to say something dumb. I'm not afraid to act stupid or goofy. I'm not afraid to just be like totally bubbly and over the top. And in some way, to me, that's like exposing more of myself. So that was a hard thing to hear.
So they felt there was a discord between the bubbly Lucille Ball-ish Ben de la Creme and the emo Ben out of drag.
Well, I don't like, you know, they don't see, the judges don't see me out of drag. So they just were like, this character isn't, you know, Michelle was like, you're always in character and I don't like see you, you know. And part of this is just, you know, something that is part of this is the reason I never auditioned for Drag Race before this season, is because I, there's a lot of different ways of doing drag, and some people are themselves in drag and I'm not, you know. Like, I love the tradition of character queens. I love Dame Edna, Varla Jean Merman, you know, these queens who embody someone different, and you get to feel like, oh my God, I'm, you know, it's like the gay adult male equivalent of meeting Mickey Mouse. You know, it's like, this thing is more fantastic and like, and than real life.
It, well,
like,
we grew up with Pee Wee Herman and Elvira and all these characters. So, and there seemed to be this unspoken rule that you never got out of character ever for the cameras. And now I think that we've changed as a society. We see Cassandra Peterson, we see Paul Rubens out of drag.
Right, but you know, but still, when Cassandra Peterson is in Elvira gear, she doesn't step out of that headspace. You know, she like when Paul Rubin is in that suit, he's Pee-wee, and he's, I mean, like, and he's genius. I mean, I honestly consider Paul Rubin one of my biggest influences in terms of character stuff, because like you see the difference between him in his live stage show, in Pee-wee on TV, and then like his Letterman appearances. I mean, it's brilliant watching him have all these different kinds of levels of who this Pee-wee character is that can navigate like a totally fantasy space or like a real life situation. And that's kind of what I've always aspired to.
I used to be like, my drag used to be that same way. And then at a certain point in my life, I just wanted to like authenticity. I felt like I was working for somebody else. Like, you know, as maybe, I don't know if you've ever felt this about Ben de la Creme, but it's like Ben de la Creme isn't me and I work for Ben de la Creme.
You know, I mean, I think that I know what you're saying. I really do feel like for me, there is an authenticity that I found like through that. But I also think that it's like I think of it less as like one's working for the other and more like it's a symbiotic relationship. Like I think that
takes up all your time, all your energy, doesn't
takes
get
all
you,
your money,
all your money, and gives you a little bit of attention.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know if it's so much about attention. I mean, it really is like I have these kind of dueling desires in me, which is like I love to be like out and talking to people and like in the, you know, the thick of the nightlife and, you know, on stage. But, you know, there's another part of me that really is like I'm kind of a homebody. I'm pretty private. I just have kind of a few close friends. And those things are, you know, potentially super in opposition, but I've kind of found a way that really works for me to exercise both of them.
We got some amazing questions from our listeners on the website and all over the internet. Let's go to them. Bryce wants to know, as one of the more polished queens this season, it seemed a few of the judges were too critical of your drag persona and style. Do you think your judge a little bit harsher than the rest due to the fact that you look like Michelle Visage?
I don't. I feel like the more like interesting answer would be some sort of conspiracy theory, but I do not. You know, I think that, again, I don't think they quite knew what to do with me because, like I said, it was a weird decision to bring character drag onto reality TV because they're maybe not made for each other. And I think that was really the thing, was like, I wasn't doing maybe reality TV friendly drag. And I just kind of refused.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know what I mean? I didn't want to, I knew that I could go in and just wear Ben de la Creme's face and body and talk like Ben, but I knew that that wouldn't behoove me in the long run because I need people to know who they're going to see.
That's kind of what I think about Sharon Needles. Like, Sharon Needles created this character, Aaron created this character, and then became Sharon Needles, almost like his psyche had a transgendered, was rewired to become his character. And I've noticed that in a lot of drag performers that might have, that they kind of like grow, the character becomes them.
So you're saying
it's like,
that,
like Venom and Spider-Man, the costume right. and then takes you over.
So that they don't step out of it in drag, is that what you mean?
They never step out. They're lost in the character, and they're always in character.
The character takes over, becomes the primary persona.
Yeah, you know, and to me, there's something where it's like, you know, like I'm really glad I've been doing this kind of character drag for as long as I have, because I feel like I am like, now that it's, like, I'm getting kind of the level of attention I am, I'm not worried about losing myself to Dela, you know? Like, I'm not going to become her, because I do, you know, keep us separate and kind of have my, my relationship with both identities, you know? Does that make sense?
You have, three personas then, Tina Angst, Ben De La Creme, and then Ben...
No, Tina Angst is dead. She was assassinated live on stage before I left Chicago.
I saw that, but I thought it was just for fun.
No, she's dead. I killed her.
So you knew you're like, she's gonna be gone, and like, I'm going to Seattle, and I'm gonna create a new character.
Yeah, I was just feeling done with her. I was feeling like, you know, the Tina Angst character was really coming out of sort of my late teen, early 20s kind of, you know, I really associated with like the Riot Girl movement and a lot of the kind of like queer punk anarchist kind of associations, which, you know, I still think there's a, like, you know, and it's not like I changed my mind. I just moved from sort of being like, oh, I want to address this with like anger and spit and vinegar, to being like, oh, I'd rather like lead something in a different direction by setting an example of what I'd like to see instead.
Erica Redig wants to ask a question and along those similar lines. You have such a strong sense of social justice that comes out whenever you speak and often in your performances on stage. You've obviously put a lot of thought into it. Where does your sense of social justice come from?
I don't know.
I think she's maybe talking about the she-male clocking controversy.
Because you won, didn't you win that challenge?
I did. I won that mini challenge. I was very, you know, it was weird because I, you know, on set, I addressed like, I'm not super comfortable using this terminology. I don't really feel like great about this, but
so you brought it up to them. They were aware that you were like, this is going to cause you some trouble.
Well, I think that frequently I come off as like, you know, like people are like, oh, this like, you know, now I'm a Pacific Northwesterner. And that is like, you know, there's stereotypes about that and this kind of like political correctness. And I'm putting my fingers in the air in quotes, because I think political, like the concept of politically correct is like, I would love us all to retire that term. It's like getting it's so,
it's well, getting it was coined so, by conservatives.
Right.
Why not just, if something's offensive, why not just say that's offensive?
Right. Like every time somebody actually brings up an intelligent conversation about like, hey, should we be thinking about this differently? The easiest way to shut it down and say, no, I'm not having this conversation is to say, oh, you're being too politically correct.
So what was that conversation like between you and the people on the staff or the producers?
You know, it was short. It was like, you know, I mean, it wasn't like anybody, you know, I'm certainly not trying to, you know, imply that somehow I like got on a soapbox and was like, this is wrong. And everybody was like, mm-hmm. Boo, you know, I was like, you know, I'm not super comfortable with this. Like, what is this all, you know, gonna mean? And essentially what was going on is they're trying to film a TV show and we've only got a certain amount of hours in a day. And they like, you know, and I think they kind of didn't register what I was saying because they were like, we don't really have time to talk about this. We kind of have to keep shooting, you know? And so it wasn't like they were being like these evil, inconsiderate, heartless villains. They just really were like, you know, they were thinking about something else. They were on like a TV production schedule and they were trying to make that happen. So
did anybody else voice concern over this, or was it just...
I think Courtney talked about it as well. Yeah.
Wow. So they were like,
yeah, I feel like when Courtney was on the podcast,
she talked about it. I don't think it had happened yet.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I don't think it had happened.
But she was kind of hinting to, you know, it was like foreshadowed. There was a little bit of controversy. And my feeling is like, it is possible to celebrate the outrageous nature of drag queens and also at the same time, you know, use a little restraint in the words that you use.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know why it's become such a prevalent idea in both drag and gay culture that, like, we just get to, like, somehow being gay men and or being drag queens means we get to, like, say whatever the fuck we want about anybody. Like, I'm like... Like, yeah, we have dealt with oppression and we're, like, a minority, but, like... Like, I don't see why that gives you like carte blanche to just like I don't know, not think that your language like contributes to the world around you. You know, I mean, the way does the energy, like the thoughts and the words that we choose to like put into the world affect the world. And if we want, you know, I mean, even if it's in a super minor way, you know, I mean, I know that a lot of people are like, oh, that's sort of a grandiose idea, but, you know, like you're, for instance, okay, so as I'm going to kind of relate it back to a little bit of what we were talking about, where, you know, as a character queen, I put this really like positive character out there. I don't always feel that. I'm not always nice. I don't always have like the like sweetest ideas, you know, but like because I put that energy out there, I wind up getting that energy back, and it makes me more actually like that. Like I think I'm actually a more positive person because of that cycle. And at some point you just have to decide that, like, you know, this sort of like, you know, like patting the dust off your hands and being like, well, the world's already fucked up, I might as well contribute to it. It's like you're just, you know, you're making that happen over and over again.
But I think sometimes when we are disenfranchised or we feel bad about ourselves, punching down or looking down upon other people makes us feel better about ourselves.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I can definitely understand where it comes from, and I have like empathy for it. You know, I think that, it's, I mean, that's like a really classic psychological cycle, is that, you know, if you've been bullied, you tend to bully. And that's a very loaded word, but yeah, it's like when you have come from a place of not being in power and suddenly you get to a place in your life where you like find a community that accepts you, you know, it's very easy to slip into that, unconsciously to slip into that cycle of kind of trying to elevate yourself up by, you know, pushing others down a little bit.
Well, it's kind of like when we work in a place where somebody becomes a manager and then suddenly they're assholes to everybody.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
The thing is, though, too, is like, you know, the show has got a huge following. And so, you know, you think because RuPaul uses the word shemale that it's everywhere and the drag queens are tossing around the word shemale left and right. You're in, you know, you do drag how many nights a week? How often do you actually hear people call each other a shemale?
Right, yeah, I mean, like, it's not a big part of, like, my community, but...
I don't know any community that's part of other than the sex workers, you know?
And sex workers have to use tranny and shemale, otherwise they don't make money. It's a life-or-death situation. If you're a sex worker or a porn star and you're transgender, these are the words you use to market your work. And if you don't use them, it's robbing you from being able to exist.
Because nobody's searching for trans asterisk porn. Nobody.
Right. Yeah.
Or genderqueer porn or something. So, I mean, I think, it, you know, part of the reason that you have this consciousness about this is because you and Courtney have a background in civil disobedience and politics and activism and you guys went to college.
Well, and I was raised, I mean, my Chicago years really defined a lot of this for me. Like I was kind of like raised by activist performers in Chicago. You know, I mean, that burlesque show that we were talking about earlier, a lot of the folks who were involved in that, you know, it was the Lickety Split Radical Cheerleaders at the time were involved. Girlesque Burlesque was its own group. The Chicago Kings were overlapped with that. And these were a lot of, performance groups in Chicago happening at the time who were doing really like irreverent, fun stuff on stage. And they were creating these kind of like alternative, like queer party atmospheres, but they were really politically charged. They really had like strong opinions about the messages that they wanted to put out or didn't want to put on stage. And
well, it's like the generation that just came before it, Queer Nation and the Lesbian Avengers and ACT UP, were using theater and performance to draw media attention to the AIDS crisis, to all sorts of other injustices in society. And so theater and performance really became a very important part of our political discourse. And I think now we've sort of forgotten about those roots that we just had 10 years ago, even.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's, you know, there's two things going on where it's like really exciting that we are able to, I mean, when I say we, like any sort of queer or gay performer artist, like we're at a place culturally now where we get to not thinking about that stuff. And that's awesome. You know, I mean, the fact that, like, if an artist just chooses to be kind of a popular artist who doesn't want to be addressing those things, I mean, that's like an amazing thing that we've made it there in our culture. At the same time, I think I don't want to see everybody lose track of all of that. You know, I don't think that everybody needs to be, you know, scholarly about it or whatever. But I also think that it's important to understand the struggle that got us to this point.
When I feel like the whole, you know, quarrel between the whole shemale and, you know, and RuPaul and transgender bloggers is really stemming like a cultural gap, a generational gap that we have. That, you know, part of it is like a little love, a little kindness, and a little, you know, flexibility would make all this go away and help to unite us. And it would be really nice if RuPaul, if you're listening, to actually speak about this in a public setting, in an interview on your own podcast, where we can sort of be brought together as a community. Because if anybody can do it, it's RuPaul.
Because RuPaul must have known that people were going to get offended by this, because she's always talking about how we live in a society that likes to get offended because she can't shut up about it. So she knew that this would be controversial.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Richard Streetman has a question. How do you feel about Michelle Visage and others on the show calling you Bendela instead of Ben or Della? I thought it was your name until I watched Whatcha Packin'. Every hometown queen, Jinx Monsoon, has started calling you that. What's up with
what
that?
What is your name?
What
do you want to be called? What do you not like to be called?
All right, I'll give you the whole breakdown lineage. So Bendela Creme as a name actually came out of when I first moved to Seattle. My first performance job here was I got a job as the MC at this cabaret called the Can Can, which is down the Pike Place Market, and it's a great place. So you have these amazing dancers and blah blah blah. But so my job was I auditioned in drag to be the MC, and the owner thought that, and this is like ludicrous to me, the owner thought that me being in drag was like too much for their audience, but he thought what wouldn't be too much is if I was like gender fuck, which I'm sorry, that is way more challenging to straight audiences. That's like
just be kind of manly but kind of womanly as well,
right? Like I was like, so I was like, I didn't wear wigs or boobs or anything, and I didn't talk, but I was like wearing heels and like tons of makeup and sort of these weird like kind of military outfits with like underwear and garter belts. I mean, it was very, you know, like,
were
in
you
my
talking?
I wasn't talking. And I loved it. Like, I was totally into it. It was kind of a thing I hadn't done before, and I was having a really fun time. But Bendela Creme was the name that I chose when I did that, because I was also, so like, sometimes I would do drag, and sometimes I would do boy, and sometimes I would do this gender fuck. And so I was like, okay, well, I need this kind of blanket thing that sort of says who I am as a performer and artist. So that's where Bendela Creme came from. And then when I stopped performing there, I was like, well, no, I really want to move back to drag. Like, that's really where my passion lies. So, but at the time, but like, I'd already sort of made my name in Seattle. So booking wise, I was still working under Bendela Creme. And I kind of decided, okay, Bendela Creme is just me now. Bendela Creme is like the whole thing. And the elements of it are that Dela is the drag queen who like lives in Bendela Creme, and Ben is like the boy that lives in Bendela Creme. It's a kind of convoluted idea, but it's how I think about it.
So are you all one word, Bendela Creme, like the way Logo spells it on their blog, on your website, Ben space Dela Creme?
My website's all one word too.
No, sweetie, go to the about section. At least, I mean, as of the taping of this, Ben.
Oh, hell no. All right, I gotta get
up. So do you like being called Bendela?
I don't mind it. I mean, like, you know, it's one of these things where like, so that's my big convoluted answer to what it all means. But I'm not like throwing a fit about anything. Jinx started calling me Bendela actually before this. Bendela. Okay.
Just to clarify here, so I don't get wrong. It's Dela Creme on your website, and then Bendela Creme, all one word.
Yeah.
So do we call you Dela Creme or Bendela?
You can call me whatever you want. I'm not like in a, we're not like
Krem if you're nasty.
Miss Krem if you're nasty. Dela is what a lot of like Dela is what people in Seattle started calling me for short when I was in drag, and so that's what I adopted. So
I like the Jewish Jewification of your name since you're so close to Jinx Monsoon.
Well, that's where it came. That's the like the first Bendela. Time I was called Bendela was you know Jinx. So I have a show, a holiday show that I do with a bunch of other performers here. My best friends Kitten LaRue and Lou Henry Hoover and I produce this holiday show called Homo for the Holidays. And in it, Jinx and her, Jinx plays, a couple of different characters, but one of them is the Jewish neighbor. And that's when she started referring to me as Bendela.
Bendela, why don't you come over and let's have some tea?
Yeah. Bendela, I noticed that you didn't have a menorah on your mantle. I brought you one. How about?
Well, when we've talked to Jinx Monsoon on the show, she says that you were very critical in her pursuing a drag career. That for a while, she was like, you know, drag's not paying the bills. I want to get booked as an actor. Why am I even dressing up in drag? So you guys kind of have both encouraged and inspired each other to be fierce drag queens.
Oh, you mean critical, like influential, not
yes,
critical.
Yes, important.
Like, I was like, I don't think I was ever critical of her being in drag. Right.
Are you, this is the kind of same situation you had with Bianca Del Rio, where you were trying to say, what was the word choice that you said?
Oh my God. I said she was sailing through, and I honestly meant it.
She interpreted that as an insult.
Yeah. And I don't know what a better word choice would have been, but I didn't like, you know, I meant like, it's like, I don't know. I wasn't trying to say something shitty to her. I really was just trying.
You were leaving the competition in the dust, which is true, you know,
yeah.
and everybody, it's almost anticlimactic because it feels like Bianca's already won. Regardless of what the judges decide to do.
Well, I mean, and here's something something that's happening right now after like just being eliminated is I'm getting some reactions that are like, oh, it's okay. And I'm like, I know it's okay because I already feel like I've kind of won too. I mean, there's nobody that's coming out. Mm-hmm. Like if you've made it this far in the competition, like, you know, $100,000 is a really nice thing, but it's at this point we're going on Drag Race because we want to get to have our careers as drag queens be more sustainable and have more longevity. And nobody in the top five is going to have an issue with that.
Well, and too, I mean, you won Snatch Game, and it kind of seems like for the show, the pinnacle of the show is Snatch Game. If you do well at Snatch Game, you're going to have a good career.
Yeah, you know, and I feel like I've had such an amazing response from people. I've had so many people reach out to me and so many people excited about you know, there's lots of people that aren't excited about the drag I'm doing too, but like I stayed true to it in spite of that, and I've found the people who want to see what I do, and that's honestly, I think the best thing I could have gotten out of this experience is I found my audience, you know, or a broader, I had an audience, but I found a broader.
Well, and it's nice also that you and Jinx share this experience since you two have been so close throughout the years.
It's true. It's been like a bummer this last year. Like, I have to say that one reason that, like, one thing that was like a really big incentive for me to audition was I was like, well, I want to be working with Jinx again, but she's always like off touring now. So now we're going to get to actually do projects together again.
Well, and unlike Alaska, you didn't have to sleep with Jinx to get on the show.
Well, I'm excited. I want to come to San Francisco and see you and Jinx with Peaches Christ in the pre-show for Hocus Pocus at the end of September. That sounds like it's going to be fabulous. I assume you're playing Sarah Jessica Parker.
No!
Kathy Najimy, hello.
Yeah?
That is so much shade, Mark.
So who's
everybody knows the ugly girl plays Sarah Jessica Parker.
Well, there's still some details that are...
Because Jinx has got to be Bette, right?
We're going to have to wait and reveal details as we come because we've still got a lot of things that we have to figure out.
It's obvious that it's Jinx is Bette, you are Kathy Najimy, and Peaches is the ugly one. Is that right, Jessica Parker?
Nope.
Peaches actually has a question for you. She wants to know if you've been enjoying the outrage fans have been expressing over her sashay away. I was in LA when the decision came down and feared there would be riots. I heard a rumor about a show she's doing in San Francisco September 27th, which is also Folsom Street Fair weekend. Are you planning on getting fisted as well? When in Rome?
Oh my word. No fisting for me, thank you. And yeah, no, it's wait, what was the original question? I got distracted by fisting.
You know, I hate it when people ask like six questions in their question.
Peaches just wanted us to plug Hocus Pocus. She doesn't really care what the answer to your question was.
Oh, okay.
Are you enjoying the support people are getting? Because when you were eliminated, people booed.
They
were booing. They were like, because everybody expected Darian to get her comeuppance for being, because, you know, she was portrayed as a bitch. And I know they probably took like that 1 or 2% of all the things she said, but that was the storyline that they went with.
Here's the thing. I've had like 6 months or whatever it's been. I mean, longer, like 8 months or whatever it's been since we shot, to come to terms with leaving when I did, mm-hmm. you know? So I do at this point, I'm like, oh, I really kind of got what I needed out of this experience. But I didn't feel that way for a long time. You know, I felt really like, oh, crap, I don't feel like this was my time to go. And so there is, like, even though I'd kind of come to terms with it, having people have this insane reaction is really feels cathartic.
Now, when you left, you wrote a message on the mirror, everybody does, but how many tubes of lipstick did yours take? Because yours is the longest message ever in the history of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Three tubes of lipstick.
Oh my god. Because it's, and you wrote, Darian, I knew the second I was up against you, I was out the door. You get it, lady. I wish you all the luck in the world and only harbor enough resentment to write a long, pointless message that you will have to clean and clean and clean and clean. What is it that you think Darian gets that you didn't?
You know, I think she just, like, I think she's, God, I don't know, that was 8 months ago.
I've done a lot of drugs, okay?
you know, I think that Darian just, like, understood some things about playing the game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that in some way I went into Drag Race being like, I am going to be super true to what I do and super earnest at kind of any cost. Like, I'm going to, like, that's sort of what my priority was. And, you know, I never, like, necessarily thought I was going to, like, win Drag Race, you know? Like, I thought it would be nice, but I wasn't like, I'm going to do whatever it takes to win. I was like, I'm going to do whatever it takes so that by the time I leave here, I know that I've got my path well laid out for me.
So it wasn't like you were trying to kill Darian with kindness?
No. I mean, I just, like...
Just be like, if you're going to be a bitch to me, I'm going to be twice as nice to you. Because you never, ever once snapped back at her, at least that we get to see.
Yeah, no, and I really didn't, you know, and it's not that, you know, and it's not that that's like not a natural inclination for me. It's just not what I wanted to be like, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, and I think it's interesting because there's a little bit, I've heard some people sort of critique this idea. Like, I've heard some people say like, oh, Ben's like fake nice, like whatever, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and I think that that's like less in response to my character and more in response to like kind of, well, why didn't you ever snap back at Darian? And the reality is that, yes, sometimes to be like to take the high road, you have to like kind of fake it till it's real. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I feel like people are fake bitchy all the time and nobody critiques them for that.
Wasn't that part of being a queen, though, is you get to be fake bitchy? Isn't that that's the bonus? That's the gravy.
Yeah, I guess so. I just feel like... I don't think that I don't think that it's disingenuous mm-hmm. to strive to be nice to someone.
I wonder, and this might be controversial, and Fausto will probably hate me for bringing it up, but I was reading because I was kind of interested in the way you speak, especially when you're as a boy, and uh-huh. then when you talk, you do up talk. Do you know what I'm, you know, where it sounds like you're sounding like a question. So I was just like,
it's Valley Girl.
It's Valley
slang.
Girl slang, I guess is where it came from. And I was kind of doing a little research on it, and they said if you want a promotion, then don't upspeak.
There's a new study that says if you talk like a Valley Girl, it's going to cost you your job.
Right. And for those that don't know, upspeak, uptalk, or high-rising terminal describes a speech pattern where someone ends his or her sentences with a higher pitch or upward inflection, similar to the way we do when we ask a question. But the effect of uptalk is almost as if we are questioning our own statements and therefore subconsciously tells our listeners that we are either not sure of ourselves or what we are saying, we feel inferior to them, or we somehow seek their approval. And the bosses find uptalk not only annoying, but the majority believe uptalk hinders the prospects of promotion as well as better pay grades. 85% believe uptalk is a clear indicator of a person's insecurity and emotional weakness. 70% find uptalk a particularly annoying trait. 57% confirm that uptalk has the potential to damage a person's professional credibility. You know, so I
well,
just
thank
like,
God I never have to have a real job.
You think that's really annoying?
Well, here's the thing is like that might be an issue if I were like a banker or whatever, but I don't think that have you heard the way Adore Delano talks? I mean, she'd never get a job at Bennigan's, but she's a fucking great drag queen. It doesn't, you know, like we work in sort of a niche market.
I think it's endearing. I think it's, you know, the way young teenagers talk, and it's like we are too much like, you know, everything is fun and a question, you know. So I don't know. I don't think it's that big of a deal.
But also, too, Alfonso and I, you know, early on in the podcast, because, you know, you've listened to the podcast before when we do our intros, and we have those bullet points. Fausto used to always try and get me to do uptalk on those bullet points, and I was just like, it's sounding like a question instead of a statement.
Well,
just like,
the opposite is true. When you're trying to ask a question and you read it as a statement, It doesn't sound like a question, and it confuses the listener. Here's an example. Here's a question from Nestor Guerrero. Is there any one thing you regret not doing on the show? Versus, is there any one thing that you regret
not doing on the show?
Like, I don't even know what I'm saying anymore.
Well, also, but like,
you guys are really underestimating my grasp of language if you don't think I understand.
No, I don't understand it anymore. I don't even know what.
But I wonder
are we speaking
if,
English at
I
all?
Wonder if, like, subconsciously, because that's the way you speak, you were telling RuPaul, I don't really know who I am, and I don't feel very confident who I am as a performer, and maybe that's why Michelle was saying we don't know you, and because maybe your speech because
it's a West Coast thing more than an East Coast, and RuPaul and Michelle are definitely East Coast girls.
Well, and also too, though, the Upspeak has really traveled across the country and like into Canada now, and you know, even in the UK, people are using it. And people,
there's the Australian, and Courtney Act does this too. The Australians
do it a little bit too. Sometimes.
There's a word for it though. The Australian question tone or something.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what that was. I remember I watched the video on it, but.
Anyways, but so it's just food for thought there. Nestor Guerrero, is there any one thing that you regret not doing on the show that you wanted to do? Besides
win.
Being stripping. Besides stripping and winning.
Stripping and winning are my two like main things, I guess.
Okay. Jenna wants to know who really was your biggest competition this season?
This sounds really hokey, but the real answer is like me. You know, I mean, that's like No, I know it is. But like there was a certain point in the competition when like after that like time where I didn't get eliminated, where my confidence was so like I was so kind of I'd lost so much of my momentum and I lost a lot of confidence where like I mean that comedy challenge was one of the most like I mean that was like so horrible to be like still in that frame of mind that I could not pull myself up and like do something that I feel like I you know I mean I speak to audiences on stage all day long, that's what I do, you know. So but I was still so shaken from that, and it really was that thing where it was like I couldn't stop telling myself that I was failing at that point, you know? So, I mean, I know that sounds like a very stock answer, but that was actually my most difficult point in the competition where, like, I wasn't sure I was ever going to start succeeding again. And it was because I had a really hard time telling myself that I could do it again. And you know who actually really helped me was Courtney Act. I couldn't get out of the cycle of negative thinking. And Courtney, like, you know, she's somebody who thinks about her interior life a lot. She does a lot of meditation. She's really intentional about kind of how she the energy that she puts out and that she puts inside herself. And she really was like, you know, she was like, you have to stop thinking about what could go wrong. You have to start telling yourself the story of what could go right. And as soon as I started doing that, I started doing well in the competition again.
It is, though, a situation when you see someone else failing that it gives you confidence to do better on stage. You're like, well, The bar's been set low.
Right.
So you're taping the reunion show this Monday coming up. What are you going to wear?
You're going to watch it on TV. I'm wearing a burlesque gown. Duh. Ooh.
Nice. I want to read Michelle Visage for saying that your executive realness wasn't real enough. And I said, I'm sorry, but that's what Bette Midler wore, a pink version of what she wore in the movie Big Business, where
that
she plays a corporate executive.
What I was referencing.
That's what, and so when she said that on stage, you say, have you ever seen the movie Big Business with Bette Midler?
This is why audiences were
booing, because they knew that about that dress and they were like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Well, I even said it to Rue in the workroom, and then you heard Rue say it on the main stage. Like, when I'm walking on the runway, Rue is like, ooh, Bette Midler realness or something. Like, her commentary over it does say that, but they don't bring it up in the critique.
Interesting. Wow. So, you know, I guess it's like, I'm wondering if, you know, you're comfortable with the fact that in order for this show to exist, to be funded, to be allowed to be on Logo, to be on television, it has to be a competition.
Yeah.
This is the show that RuPaul was able to make. I'm sure in an ideal world, RuPaul wouldn't want to make a competition based show. She would rather have a show that introduces these girls and has them cooperating with each other as opposed to like stabbing each other in the back.
Yeah, for sure.
So we already asked that one. Who did you consider to be your biggest competition, Jenna? Besides, was yourself, right? Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. But you know, like the thing is, it's like Like, I really would say that's my real answer. I feel like, you know, in terms of, like, who else was, like, amazing on the show, I mean, there's a thing, like, right, like, it's like Bianca Del Rio is clearly super, super skilled and was doing amazing. But, again, I never felt like I was in competition with Bianca, because I wasn't going to be a better Bianca than Bianca was. I just had to keep doing exactly what I do as well as I could.
But when RuPaul asked you guys who needs to go home, I would have just said it's like the person who came up with that stupid divisive question.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, that's a question you can't win.
Right.
It's no matter who you answer, if it's yourself or somebody else, it's you're not going to win. You're setting up everybody to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Will Bush on Facebook wants to know, are you looking for a husband? Will's pretty cute.
Is he?
Yeah. You know who might be looking for a husband is Prince Harry. He said if his relationship with his girlfriend doesn't turn out, he's going to go gay.
He might go gay.
Oh, I missed this news.
Yeah, it's all of, it's like, basically.
I guess he's partying in South Beach right now.
Yeah.
I think he did break up with that girl, so maybe.
Ooh.
All right. Ginge.
Well, yeah, Prince William then. I pick him.
Grayson Rogue says, I love Della. Does she regret giving Adora diamonds because it was the easiest?
No, I love Adora. I really, like, it's interesting that on set, I actually feel like I feel pretty close with a lot of the girls now, but during actual taping, Adora and I were actually very, very close, and it's interesting because it didn't really make it on the show, but I think, you know, I don't think for any, like, insidious reason, just because, you know, there's only so much time, but yeah, no, I mean, like, I was, like, really happy to, like, help Adore step ahead. I think she's, like, a fantastic person. She's really genuine. She's really kind. She's really thoughtful. I know she gets a lot of flack for seeming dumb or whatever, but she's got a sharp mind.
And she can just talk nonstop. That's just what's so amazing about her. When you look at her video blog, she just keeps on going and going and going. And hardly or a pause or a like or anything.
And there's content there, you know? I mean, she's actually has something she wants to communicate, which is
Luis Magana Grasschild writes, do you think the show portrayed you differently than how you normally are? Is the show over-dramatized?
Yes, the show is over-dramatized. I don't think that there was any... I think it's a fairly accurate representation of me, actually, you know? I think, I feel like people got to know sort of the gist of, you know, it's hard because I've like, I think it's too short of a time to really like have the full picture about anybody, you know, but I feel like what was on there was like relatively accurate.
Luis Diego wants to know about your childhood obesity. On the Snatch Game episode, Ben mentioned how he was overweight when he was young. Yet both Ben and Della look confident on the beautiful body they have now. How did you overcome that weight to be at the one you are currently right now? Was your inspiration? I'm currently trying to lose weight to the body I want to be, so I would love to know what was the biggest thought process in your case. Thanks in advance. Well, also, you're a husky teenage boy's patron saint. Inspiration, yeah.
It's very sweet. And I've gotten a lot of kind of letters and notes like that. And the biggest thing that I kind of want to say in general to that is my story of triumph or whatever that I was trying to tell in the story is not that I lost weight. It's that I found a way to feel better about myself. And that is what, and I think, firstly, I think striving for that instead of striving to be thin ultimately will help you to make decisions that make you feel better in your body once you stop focusing on trying to make your body what you think it's supposed to be. But also, my weight still fluctuates. I was very thin on the show. I mean, I actually lost a ton of weight while I was there.
You can tell when you're watching the show, like your last episode, you're like, Fausto and I commented to each other, I'm like, he looks a lot thinner. He must have lost some weight during the taping.
I was like, when I started going there, I was like, oh, I want to watch my figure. I'm eating salads and whatever. By the time we were done, I was like, give me pizza, give me burgers, give me whatever, because I could not, like, I was dropping weight, I think just from stress, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was like trying to actually eat as many calories as I could, because I was like, I don't want to be this skinny on this show because I do not identify as this skinny, and I don't ever plan on being this skinny again. Like, I'm not, we're about to go film this reunion. I'm about 10 pounds heavier, and honestly, this is more accurate to what I think is reasonable for me, and
so you're a little thick and juicy like Roxy Andrews.
Yeah. I think that being a part of the burlesque scene for so long really helped me to get really comfortable in my body. The fact that people sort of, people see what they want to see because of how you carry yourself and how you feel about yourself.
And burlesque is very body positive. And burlesque artists always laugh when I tell them this joke. The only difference between a stripper and a burlesque artist is 50 pounds.
Well, and it's
most burlesque people laugh at that, not you.
No. I think there's definitely permission in the burlesque world to like have a bigger body. And I definitely, when I started doing burlesque, it was at a phase in my life where I was like much thinner. And I felt really confident about putting my body on stage and taking my clothes off kind of because of that. But I started gaining weight again as I was doing it. And it was a really good lesson for me because I realized that as long as I carried myself the same way, as long as I still performed with confidence, the amount of weight on my frame didn't actually affect how the audience responded to me.
Brina Thompson, did you have a drag mother who taught you how to beat your mug and all that good stuff? Or are you a lone wolf prowling the desert by moonlight?
Wow, what a beautiful way of painting with words. I taught myself to paint. I was just like always really interested in makeup when I was a kid, and I had a lot of free time because I didn't have many friends because I was a weirdo. So I would steal makeup from the drugstore and like go home and lock myself in my bathroom and like try putting on makeup when I was a kid, so that by the time I was actually like moving to a city, I actually kind of already knew my way around it.
Wow. So you're not like a booger queen when you first stepped out into the bars?
I mean, like, I look at pictures of myself from when I was 21 and I'm like, oh God, put on like six times more. But I definitely, it wasn't like I put on makeup for the first time and was in public,
Did being in that intense situation with all the other drag queens affect the way you put on makeup?
I don't think so, because, and I think, again, I have a little bit of a different approach to how I do my makeup. Because I don't really, I think Ben de la Creme has a facial structure, and it has to be that, because that's what that character looks like, So I don't, her eyes are shaped a certain way, her cheeks are shaped a certain way. And so there wasn't like any sort of temptation to sway away from that, because I think of it as just being kind of what she looks like as a person. You know what I mean?
Daniel Alejandro, I love your acts on YouTube. I'm so impressed by the amount of effort you put into them. How long does it take to prepare, choreograph, and make a number? Now, one that people really love is your Little Mermaid tribute, where she pulls out a box of dildos. How long? Like, I mean, you put a lot of time and energy, not just into the costume, but into like conceiving it and editing the audio and rehearsing it.
Yeah, you know, I tend to be. I'm not very methodical. I'm sort of like a. Just kind of a whirlwind, and I'll like sit around for a long time and like not really like have any ideas, and then something will come to me, and then I'll just like really quickly bang it out and just like not sleep for a week, you know? So it's like when I got that Little Mermaid idea, it was like, I think 4 days before I wanted to put on stage, and I like, you know, had my friend sew the costume I wanted, and I like collected all the props, and I edited the music, and I choreographed it, and I did the thing. And it was just, you know, it was one of those. But I feel like that only comes out of having like a lot of like letting yourself dream for a long time. And then when the idea comes, you just like do it.
Chad Sell is a huge fan of yours, and he's a big, supporter and draws you probably more than any of the queens this season.
I love him so much.
He's an extraordinary, illustrator. He's going to be joining us with Tin Tim Masti Nassim. Work it, honey. The video blogger on the season finale of RuPaul's Drag Race. We're going to talk about all the themes and ideas that came up during this season, including the controversial she-male gate.
Yeah.
Della, did you make any conscious adjustments to your depiction of your character during the shooting of the season? I feel like you dialed back the more manic aspects of your personality in later episodes, especially during the talk show challenge. I send you my love.
Yeah, you know, there's a thing where I have been navigating this character in a lot of, like I was talking about Paul Rubens before and how he has kind of different kinds of peewees, but they're all peewee. And I've had to do a lot of different situations as Dela, and sometimes she's a host and she's interacting with an audience, and sometimes she's in a play and she's just a character, and sometimes she's on stage and she's interviewing, like that kind of interview format is something I've done on stage a lot. So like all those volumes of Dela are things that I'm accustomed to. And when I realized, you know, and so, I mean, for one thing, that was just like the appropriate way to deal with that particular challenge. But I also was like, okay, I'm not abandoning this character. Like I don't care how much they want me to. I'm not going to let this. I'm not going to like abandon my creation. But I will try to show them all the nuance of how I can operate within it.
Annecy wants to know, what's your favorite kind of oatmeal?
My favorite kind of oatmeal is that is the instant Quaker like packet that you just mix with hot water, and it's like the cinnamon one.
Girl, you gotta do the steel cut oats. It's higher in fiber.
Yeah, I know, but I like the trashy one.
Because you can freeze the steel cut oats and put it in the freezer and thaw it, and it's like you get.
I poop plenty. I don't need any fiber. Chill out.
Who's some of your inspirations as an artist? Annecy wants to know as well.
Pee Wee Herman is actually a big one. I talk about him a lot. Maria Bamford is a comedian that I really look up to. She's like super duper funny, but she's not afraid to talk about kind of her internal crazies in a really open way, which is kind of how I think about my stuff as well.
Have you been training yourself as a comedian, as an improviser, or has the comedy been an organic process for you?
Yeah, no, it's just sort of been organic. It's just been from, you know, like just doing it over and over again for years, you know.
Do you see any challenges for yourself as an artist to grow and to be creative now that you're working so much and traveling and performing 7 days a week?
In terms of like
just having time to breathe.
Yeah, having time to breathe is definitely something that I know I need for myself. And I think one advantage to having done drag for a really long time is I know the power of the word no. You know, I'm really excited for all the opportunities coming my way, but I also know that I won't be able to operate on my optimum level if I don't take those moments to kind of check in and have some time with myself. And ultimately, that's what longevity and excess, or, you know, success, you know, that's what I need in order to, for this to be sustainable. So I'm just going to make sure it happens, you know.
Take some time off and recharge your batteries. Tim Jones wants to know, you are the first queen to ever make me want to ask a dumb fanbot question like this. Will you be my best friend?
Aww.
Oh, yes, I will.
Everybody wants to be friends with you.
That's so nice.
You are, listen, I don't know if you could sit, I think we were friends when you lived in Chicago.
Yeah, totally.
And you're like a lovely person. I mean, speaking on your behalf, like, you really are the person that we saw on television. And it's like, to me, it was always like, what the fuck is wrong with Darianne Lake?
It really did seem like that. You're just like, why is she picking on this poor person? What did Ben do?
But it seemed like it was like a chemical imbalance, something wrong was happening. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if she had a heart attack and had to be taken to the hospital in the middle of the series.
Well, you know, and I don't, like, the other, like, you can be a likable person and feel good about yourself and, like, accept that some people just aren't going to like you, you know? Yeah. Like, and, like, it doesn't make Darianne, like, a shitty person if she doesn't, if, like, my personality doesn't make sense to her or she doesn't click with me, you know?
Well, you're certainly the friend every drag queen deserves. And, you know, you're really close to Adora Delano, which we didn't get to see on the show. Green Staples from Reddit points that out. You guys are like really close.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we bonded really hardcore on the show. I just,
way. It was all Kiki and no Kai Kai.
Yeah. Kiki, no Kai Kai. But yeah. And we just sort of, you know, we've kept in touch, and I love whenever we're like booked in the same city and get to hang out. You know, and I didn't necessarily feel the same sense of closeness with, like, I felt a kinship with Courtney and Bianca, but not to the extent that I did with Adore. But I actually have to say that since filming, I've spent more time with Courtney and Bianca. And I think the experience of being out of that insane drag jail and just being in the world, kind of having a similar experience, I actually feel really close to both of them at this point, too. I mean, I'm in pretty regular contact with all three of them.
Who do you expect to win this season of RuPaul's Drag Race?
You know, I honestly don't even, like, know where to begin trying to guess that. It's like, yes, it feels like Bianca is, like, so clearly the forerunner. You know, it also feels like Adore has this, like, amazingly charming sort of underdog narrative. There's also, you know, Courtney might just do something. Well, and like Courtney's amazing. I mean, Courtney is super duper talented. We've seen, like, in the way that the actual showings have panned out, that she isn't being highlighted in quite the same way. But who knows? I mean, they just, like,
So you're admission. You're admitting that Darianne Lake has no chance of being the top three.
No, I mean, whatever, like they kicked me out, like, crown Darianne, I don't know, do whatever you want, you're like, you know.
And your best guess
could be the Tyra Sanchez of season 6.
And most people are saying for Miss Congeniality that's going to be either you or Jocelyn Fox.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a thing happening where people feel like I was wronged and they want me to have a consolation prize, and I really appreciate that sentiment, and I certainly would be, like, honored to be crowned Miss Congeniality, but in terms of what it actually is to be congenial, Jocelyn Fox is the pinnacle of that. She really is.
Well, that's what Miss Congeniality would say.
Because you get, like, money for that too, don't you? Like, $10,000? They used to give money for that.
I don't actually know.
I think there's money, yeah. So I would be girl, I got some bills to pay.
I'll buy Jocelyn dinner.
Because Jocelyn's getting married. She got herself a husband.
Her husband is amazing.
And I thought you said he's a millionaire.
Oh, no.
Amazing. Well, no, Ben de la Creme, did you hear that the rumors of Dolly Parton's lesbian rumors have been finally put to rest by Dolly Parton herself?
No, I seriously have received no news that isn't about Drag Race in a very long time. So what happened? What's going on?
Mark?
Give me 1 second.
Sure.
I'm scrolling.
So Dolly Parton, I guess, was interviewed recently, and she directly addressed the rumors.
Well, because she's been married to her husband for 50 years, but she also has a close friend named Judy Ogle. And she said, like Gayle King, her friend, Judy, my friend, they just think that you just can't be that close to somebody. Judy and I have been best friends since we were like in third or fourth grade. We still just have a great friendship and relationship, and I love her as much as I love anybody in the whole world, but we're not romantically involved, is what she told.
So it's basically the same thing as Oprah said. It's like, you know, lesbian rumors, but in fact, they're not bumping
and
pussies.
With Dolly, they say, like, out of drag, you can't even tell that it's Dolly, because I guess she has her hairline is bleach blonde, but then the rest of her hair is all black, and then she has tattoos, like sleeves, like her arms are all tattooed.
Up. That is amazing.
And so, if you saw her on the street, you wouldn't even know it's her. We're talking to somebody who actually was an esthetician for her. He worked for Oprah. We're talking to him on Sunday, so it'll be Monday's podcast. We'll get more on Oprah.
And, I want to see Dolly. Tatted, dark-haired Dolly trying.
I know.
Don't you? Yes. I want the evil alternate universe Dolly Parton.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. She's like when Samantha from Bewitched. What was Samantha from Bewitched?
Serena.
Like, sister. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Her cousin Serena.
Darwin, let's get fuck. Let's fuck on the kitchen table, groovy baby. Ben, you're coming to Chicago the 6th of June.
Fourth.
Am I?
Yes. Oh, you don't even know when you're coming.
I honestly never. I don't know what's happening anymore. My calendar just. I just keep looking at it.
They're not having the Absolute Tour any sponsored tour, so I don't know. Are the big winners going to tour like they did in seasons past? Or?
I don't know. I mean, it's like there's nothing where I'm like contractually obligated to do anything in my position, but like it doesn't like you just get to work so much, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, like there's. I think my schedule is booked through like the end of the year basically, and so so I don't know whether there's like an official tour that they go on or not, but there's going to be no shortage of opportunities to see all of these queens perform all over the country.
Have you gotten to that point already where you're basically the Santa Claus at the mall, and there's a line of 100 to 200 fans all wanting to have their photo taken with you, and you give them a lollipop?
Well, it is a little bit like that at the various club appearances. You know, they'll do like a meet and greet, and they'll sort of like section you off in like a part of the club, and then you know everybody paid like an extra $5 to come and like have their photo and say hi or whatever. I mean, it is very Santa Claus. But I have been finding that you can have like a shockingly genuine connection with somebody in that 30 seconds. You know, I've had a lot of really awesome conversations with people who have managed to, in the quick time that the bouncer is like pushing them, you know, towards me and then away from me, who have been able to express like, oh my God, you meant so much to me. I love that you talk openly about depression, and I struggled with weight as a kid too, and I just am really inspired by your character, and thank you so much, and blah, 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 blah. And then
my social security number is 482.
If you ever get lost for words, what they say, just do what Nina Flowers does. Just go, oh, just loca. Oh, just loca. Well, I said stuff to her faster, and it was everything was, oh, just loca.
Well, I don't know if she speaks English too well. You know, a lot of the Puerto Rican drag queens, I feel like they're, you know, struggling with the language.
Well, I don't know any of those queens except for April Carrion, who is very well spoken and very fluent in the English language.
But it sometimes feels like I mean, when I talk to Nina Flowers, it's like I'm not sure we're on the same planet. I mean, it was good that she was booked.
Well,
with,
that might be more of a function of her personality. Yeah.
She's very Tammy Brown in that sense.
Oh my God, I love Tammy Brown so much.
You know, so talk about some of the queens from other seasons that like you love and adore. Certainly, Jinx Monsoon is up there, and Tammy Brown. Who are some of your other dragspirations and your sisters?
Well, I always was really inspired by Manila's kind of she calls her aesthetic glamp, her like glamour camp blend. I always that really spoke to me, and I think that. You know, I think you can see that there's like a relationship in the way that she styles herself. I I'm gonna come clean for a second and say that I didn't watch Drag Race until season 4.
Really?
And, yeah, but then I went back and watched all the other seasons. But I found, and once I watched the other seasons, I was like, oh, this is amazing. I don't know why I wasn't watching this the whole time. But I was just like, oh, I've dealt with enough bitchy queens in dressing rooms. I don't need to watch them on TV. That sounds stressful, you know? But season 4 is when I started watching, and it was because, like, I saw Sharon and I was like, wait, what is this? This person is on this show? All right, I have to check this out. And, you know, Sharon really was the beginning of me starting to be like, oh, this... There's like really a lot of different kinds of things we're seeing portrayed on this program that mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily think we were going to see. And I thought her story was really touching and felt really personal. And the way that she was just kind of brave about doing the drag she wanted to do. So,
and it really changed it up because the format was like, okay, pretty queens go far. And then we see a queen that's not very pretty make it all the way to the end. And
right.
Like, finally, a different kind of drag.
You know, although Sharon talks about not being pretty, quote unquote, Sharon's beautiful. Sharon is a beautiful drag queen. She does a lot of aesthetics where
she... Have you seen her lately? She looks like Jim Carrey in The Mask in drag now. And well, I'm saying that with a total loving shade.
She, you know, she like, I think that she does a lot. I mean, whatever. She's got her like style that she does, but she's, you know, I mean, if you see her do, whenever she decides to, I mean, they were always like, why don't you do glamour drag? Why don't you do pretty drag? Which she did very early on in the season during that wrestling challenge. She was like a gorgeous blonde bombshell, you know? So she's got the capability. She just doesn't choose to. And I think that's awesome.
Mm.
So are you going to put out a single like every other drag queen in the show has?
I'm not going to put
music.
Out. No, I mean, I'm not going to put out like a dance single or anything, but I do, you know, I've been writing parody music for a long time. That's been something that I really love to do. And I've got, you know, a lot of those videos already on YouTube that are parody songs. And that's something that I still, you know, that's just something I love to do. So I'll keep doing it.
I could totally see you doing a kids' TV show on YouTube or something.
I would love to do a kids' TV show. Yeah.
I think that's like your direct, you know, follow your Pee Wee Herman inspiration.
Well, you know, I some of the shows, I mean specifically the holiday show that I do here is very much based on kind of the format of the of Pee-wee's Playhouse. I mean, it's really like you know, it's a variety show with a narrative arc where like there's kind of, you know, we use all these different kinds of forms and there doesn't have to be a logic to it, but it's still like a story. And that's super, like, I love doing that. So I would love to take that into the next phase, you know, because I have so many connections and roots in theater, in burlesque, in drag, in cabaret, in circus arts, you know, I mean, those, I know so many talented people in those worlds. I would love to create the show like Pee-wee's Playhouse that is like the gay adult version where we, you know, I get to introduce the world to a lot of these amazing artists I know that are just working in like underground cabarets.
Well, the time has come, Ben de la Creme, to wrap up the show. Your journey here does not end, but continues. We enjoyed your flavorful addition to our coffee with a little Ben de la Creme. I don't know.
Oh my goodness. You're giving me PTSD.
Is the hair on the back of your neck standing
so
up?
So is anyone, like, every time you hear somebody coming up to you and say, it's time for your lip sync for your life.
Nobody's done that yet, but if they do, I will probably just turn around and punch them.
Oh my, so it's because it's stressful.
It's not my fault. It's just, it's a reflex now. It's it's RPDR-PTSD.
Ben de la Creme, you are awesome.
You are.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for coming on the podcast, and best of luck.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Bye.
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 Bye. Hold on a second. Bye. Bye. There we go. Ben de la Creme lives in Seattle, Washington. You can check him out, her out. Get a little Ben de la Creme in your coffee at bendelacreme.com.
Ooh.
And spelled all what is that is there a word for that when you have capital letters inside a bigger name, like, you know, sort of like iPod has the capital P after the lowercase I?
I don't know. Well, I think you have to distinguish, so they do it so you can distinguish what the words are.
De la creme. De la creme. So it's very French sounding, you know? Hey, remember folks, Feast of Fun can't be happening, isn't made possible because of your financial support. Subscribe to our premium channel and get all our fabulous podcasts, all our interviews with the fierce, beautiful queens of RuPaul's Drag Race, the top drag queens of the world. Get it now, hunties. Feastoffun.com/plus.
We also have fantastic t-shirts for sale at our store, feastoffun.com/store. Get your Hunty t-shirt today, because Hunty is a school and the library is open, so start reading. We also have a Not Shaving Gives Me More Time for Misbehaving t-shirts for you butch fellas out there.
There are some of you queens who, you know,
and
rather
some of
not
the ladies
shave.
Order them too.
The milk-inspired queens who want to have a milk mustache all the time, you know, so. We want to thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Mm-hmm.